everybody, and welcome back to Read Between the Tracks. My name is Caitlin Cromley Lynn, and I am here with my wonderful friend and co-host, Jeffrey Edelstein.
Hello again.
Hello again. Today, we are going to be talking about The Stranger by Billy Joel, which is one of my all-time favorite albums. My sister Amanda gifted me a couple Christmases ago the vinyl for it, and I was over the moon excited. Kind of the same thing with Fleetwood Mac. My dad used to play Billy Joel all the time in the car. I distinctly remember the two-disc black and white cover of the Greatest Hits CD, and had a huge chunk of What's on the Stranger, which is only 9 tracks. I can't believe it is only 9 tracks, but yeah,
it's a short album.
It is a short album, but the gems that are on this album are some of his best work. It has my all-time favorite Billy Joel song on it, and I'm not going to tell you what it is yet because I don't want to ruin the suspense, but my all-time favorite Billy Joel song is on it. And Jeffrey, I think we share the same favorite all-time favorite
right
Billy it's Joel song.
One out of 9 chances you've got there to figure out which one it is. This is such an incredible album. One of his best albums.
I was going to say, what is your connection to this album?
You know, my parents love Billy Joel so much. They really related to his, like, the things that he describes in the song as, like, two New Yorkers. And Billy Joel really captured the ultimate New Yorker voice of the entire decade of the 70s. Like, he really was the young person speaking the truth of the New Yorker's life.
He had the finger on the pulse.
He had the finger on the pulse of the boomers, of, like, the boomers in New York City. And he really speaks and talks like your parents would. He really has that voice down. And it's incredible sometimes when you listen to him how ingenious he is as a lyricist and as a musician. So, like, when we talked about Elton John and Bernie Taupin, they didn't do what Billy Joel did. Elton John, amazing pianist, amazing musician, certified genius musician. Bernie Taupin, brilliant lyricist. Billy Joel's out here doing both.
I know, he's the strong man. And he has the moniker Piano Man. He has earned the title, for sure. And before we do our album background and our artist background, the book that you and I read for this episode, which is the biography Billy Joel by Fred Schur. And this is what I wanted for Elton John's music biography. Originally, Billy Joel had contacted Fred Schur to essentially ask him to help him ghostwrite an autobiography. And Billy Joel sat down and did over 100 hours of interviews.
That's insane.
So
much time.
It's a lot of time. And the crazy thing is that last minute, Billy Joel, like, backed out of the project and was like, I don't want to do this. I'm done. No, thank you. And goodbye. And then the crazier part of that was that Billy Joel could have been like, you're not allowed to use any of that material, and essentially said to Fred Schur, you can take the material that I gave you and write your own biography. I don't want to do any more interviews. I'm done now. And so Fred Schur used his interviews with Billy Joel, as well as other very prominent people in his life, to write this incredibly detailed biography that goes all the way from his ancestry to present. And if you really want to read some of Fred Schur's analysis on the albums, he does not quite track by track. He does kind of track highlights and analyzes the tempo, the words, the music, the way he uses certain devices in its songs. And as someone who enjoys that kind of analysis, it was an absolutely perfect music biography. And we'll get into some of Fred Schur's commentary on The Stranger when we do our deep dive. So Jeffrey, I will let you take the wheel and give us some background on Billy Joel and where this album lies in his discography.
So Billy Joel is one of the greats of rock and roll, one of the absolute most well-known, brilliant musicians of rock and roll history. So Billy Joel came to his real peak in the 70s. He is a multi-Grammy Award winner. He's very well known by everyone. He's a legendary pianist and really like has a fantastic ear for music. His first album, Cold Spring Harbor, which was not a big album, featured one hit that we all know, She's Got Away. And it was notoriously poorly mixed so that his voice was much higher than it actually is. And so he got out of his contract with that record company and then signed with Columbia for the smash hit 1973 album Piano Man, which came out the same year as Goodbye Yellow Brick Road. Piano Man, of course, had Piano Man on it, as well as a few other big hits, such as the Ballad of Billy the Kid and Captain Jack. Captain Jack made it onto the radio in a live version. He had two albums after that in 1974, Street Life Serenade, which did not do very well. Neither did Turnstiles, although Turnstiles has quite a few hits that people really enjoy still to this day. Say Goodbye to Hollywood, New York State of Mind, Miami 2017. And then that brings us to The Stranger, which I would say, to me, is my favorite Billy Joel album.
Mine too.
The first seven songs, he still plays in concert. You and I have both seen him in concert. You saw him twice. I saw him once. Perhaps one of his most well-known records is he's the only artist to have played Madison Square Garden more than 100 times. He had an artist in residency for several years at Madison Square Garden. He actually still does have it. He didn't stop. If he wants to do a concert at any time that the Rangers and the Knicks aren't playing, he can go in and play a concert. He has this contract with them where if there's dead air, like if the Garden can't book people, they can ask him and he'll just come in and play. He has a really crazy like contract with the Garden. And I think that's because he's Billy Joel. He is the like grand master musician of New York City.
I was going to say he is to what Bruce Springsteen is to New Jersey. Billy Joel is that to New York.
Absolutely. Certainly for like white music.
Yeah. Yes. That's totally fair.
You know, he has really like no equal in rock and roll. In that he plays the piano brilliantly. He knows how to play all these other instruments. He knows these lyrics. He writes brilliant lyrics. He actually did a classical album many years later.
Yes, I remember that.
He composed like his own classical music. He's so incredibly like diverse in his ability, but also pretty down to earth.
Right.
So I think that's a great intro for him for us to talk about like the first song on this album, which is Moving Out.
Anthony's song.
The problem I'm going to have on this is that I can't like think about these songs without
singing them. I know.
They're so infectious and they're so fun. They're so powerful.
And especially the intro, I can picture dropping the needle on my vinyl.
Right.
Takes a few seconds, then you immediately have that but like such a good solid opener, such a banger.
Such a banger. Such a total masterful banger.
So Moving Out is essentially Billy Joel's anger towards watching a lot of his friends and especially older immigrants being in the working class and having this attitude that you have to unfortunately work multiple jobs and long hours and, using one of the lyrics, break your back to afford these kinds of luxury items that give you status in America and give signal to the rest of society that you've made it.
Right.
In America, like the Cadillac. I go back to the Cadillac, and I know you and I have talked about the house in Hackensack and what that line means, but there's that line, who needs a house out in Hackensack if that's what you get for your money? But I think it's more of a commentary, like it's so expensive out in Hackensack.
Right.
Like you have the house in Hackensack, but it's either small. Or like
it's just Hackensack.
It's just Hackensack, but that means you made it. So it's a very cynical
It's extremely cynical.
And I love the sound effect. He goes into a little bit of detail how they recorded the sound effect of the screeching tires.
Yep.
Which is such a good outro of that anger and that frustration. Like, I'm moving out. Like, I'm out of here. And, like, literally burning rubber as you're moving out.
There's such extreme, like, anger and angst in this that, like, I mean, the first verse, Anthony works in the grocery store, saving his pennies for someday. Which we already know that if you're working at a grocery store, even in the 70s, what are you saving your pennies for? What are you adding up? Mama Leone left a note on the door. She said, Sonny, move out to the country. Working too hard can give you a heart attack. Ack, 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 ack.
You ought to know by now.
So the first verse tells you, this is a song about, like, you can try really hard and you're not going to get where you want. And that the system is rigged against you. You ought to know by now. You ought to know by now. It's repeated, echoed. Who needs a house out in Hackensack? Is that all you get for your money? What a biting, cynical statement that all you can amount to, if you work hard, is a house out in Hackensack. Here's that New Yorker moment where it's like the city moving into the country. Not even the country. Hackensack's not the country.
It's considered the country out in New York City.
Sure, maybe.
Maybe.
The chorus is this exasperation, and it seems such a waste of time. If that's what it's all about, mama, if that's moving up, then I'm moving out. I think the narrative of the song is kind of like referring back to Mama Leone.
Yes.
As this like character who is also exasperated by saying, Sonny, move out to the country. Working too hard can give you a heart attack. Although she's not quoted on that second line. And moving out represents this idea that you can get out of this system, because if you are a good listener, you will hear and you'll see it in the official lyrics. Mama, if that's moving up, then I'm moving out. You know, when I was a kid, I thought it was mama, if that's moving out, then I'm moving out as like an affirmation. But it's actually saying, I don't want to have this American dream moment. Right. I want to move out of this system that's oppressing me.
Right.
I want to move on to the second verse, but do you have anything you want to say?
I mean, you pretty much nailed it, especially that really hard, biting cynicism. It's not a happy song. It's a very critical song. And as I said, it's autobiographical in the sense that Billy Joel took inspiration. His family is from Germany and immigrated over to America, and he grew up in a very diverse neighborhood, and growing up was watching all these people. And I know he grew up poor as well, right. Watching all these people essentially and all these immigrants just spend so much time trying to be American or integrate into America and consider themselves successful the way that America sees success. And which is clearly different from how people from other countries see success.
Right.
But it clearly comes at a price. And I really wanted to talk about the different characters that are in the song. And I figure we could do that together because we have Anthony, we have Mama Leone, and then
our next character is Sergeant O'Leary.
Sergeant O'Leary, who I think we go from Italian stereotypes, and now we're at the Irish stereotypes.
Yeah. Well, I love this verse. I think it's such an interesting verse, the second verse. Sergeant O'Leary is walking the beat. At night, he becomes a bartender. He works at Mr. Cacciatore's down on Sullivan Street, across from the medical center. Yeah, and he's trading his Chevy for a Cadillac. Ack, ack, ack. So a few things.
Right.
Number one, Sergeant O'Leary, Irish stereotype, that Irish cops.
Yes.
And then he's a bartender, again, like Irish stereotype. But like moving away from that analysis for just a minute, the recognition that Sergeant O'Leary can't afford moving out, moving up, or the Cadillac on his income as a cop, which in the 70s, police officers were paid differently. Actually, at the time in New York City, there was the NYPD, and then the state had to create the Metropolitan Police because the NYPD was so corrupt.
Right, that's right.
If you didn't know that as like a millennial or younger or somebody who wasn't living in the city at the time, that detail actually is kind of important. And then trading in the Chevy for the Cadillac, This is something my father said. I don't know how true this is. I guess it is. But
we're going to go with it. It's our personal analysis. There are no wrong answers.
His police car would have been a Chevy. And so it's like the idea is he's trading in the Chevy that he drives for work as a cop for a Cadillac. And he's never going to do that because he's just never going to move up. The other thing I want to say about this verse is, language-wise, this verse is so interesting because this is exactly how my father talks as somebody from the Bronx. The geographic details of he works at Mr. Cacciatore's, assuming that everyone in the audience knows who Mr. Cacciatore is, which people would know a Mr. Cacciatore, down on Sullivan Street. I'm not sure which Sullivan Street this is, because if it's in the village, if it's the one in like in Manhattan, I don't know where the medical center would be. I guess that's what is now Lenox Hill Hospital on 7th Avenue down there. And across from the medical center. So like my father speaks in the same way where he'll like reference geographical locations because this, you know, in the days before Google Maps and Waze and all of that, you would navigate the city by saying it's on what street, what avenue, next to where it's close to the subway, it's far, you know, all these geographical details. And Billy Joel is like using this very conversational language to capture the essence of these characters. And I just think that's so out of this world brilliant.
It
in
is
the way
it's
that
so
Shakespeare
brilliant.
Did. It's Shakespearean in that way.
I want to say he's been called like the Bard of Long Island.
I mean, he should be.
He should be.
He's
earned
pulling
it.
The same stuff that like Chaucer and Shakespeare do.
Right. And it's not a long song. It doesn't have like a lot of verses and
it has mostly bridge and chorus,
but you have such a clear picture of all these characters that are like put into this song. You have a sense of environment, you have a sense of setting, you have a sense of struggle. There's that one line as well that follows the one that you're talking about you cannot drive with a broken back, but at least he can polish,
can
the,
polish
fender.
The fenders
biting. How
so if he breaks his back
that?
Making enough money to buy a Cadillac, all he can do is polish the fenders.
Oh,
crazy.
It's crazy. It's such a powerful opening.
At the end, we have the break. You should never argue with a crazy mind, 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 mind. If you weren't listening, you might have heard man, but it's mind. Saying that like this life of never ending breaking your back makes you crazy after a while. And the last bridge, you ought to know by now. You ought to know by now, you can pay Uncle Sam with the overtime. Is that all you get for your money? So it's this like, you try to get everything you want, which is not much. Cadillac and a house in Hackensack is really the only things that you can acquire in this song. And then you still have to pay Uncle Sam with your overtime. You can't work enough hours to pay for everything you want. And if that's what you have in mind, yeah, if that's what you have in mind, good luck moving up because I'm moving out is the last chorus.
I was going to ask you, so based on what Mama Leone says, do we think Anthony is moving out to the country? And kind of very parallel to what Elton John talks about in Goodbye Yellow Brick Road, like going back to the simple life, like moving out of the city. And that's where
I don't know.
You find happiness. Like what is the ending for Anthony? Like, where does he go?
It's so interesting.
If he's not moving up and he's moving out, where is he going? I have to assume, if we're going to analyze it, that he says, Sonny, move out to the country.
Right.
He could have said move to the country, but it's move out to the country.
Right. And that's another like language thing. Like I'll hear my parents say move up, move down, and move out, go into the city. I think that's, again, like his language of being someone who's from like the New York area.
Right.
I think the mystery of the song is like, I don't really think this is a song about New York City is too hard to live in. I don't think
no.
it's that. I think it's the whole system is too hard to live in.
Right. No, it's very true.
And that's
true.
Why we have at the end, the engine revving, the tires screeching, and the tires screeching until the end of the track.
It's such a good finality to the song.
And then we have our transition into the title song, which is The Stranger. Unironically referencing the book.
Unironically referencing the book. And I would say that this is probably in my top five favorite Billy Joel songs. You have the ominous whistle in the beginning, where you immediately get the mood of the song, or what you think is the mood of the song, and then there's like a small bit of silence, and it goes into the na 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 na, and it's, oh my god, like you immediately get hyped. It has a very simple message. It's really just about, you think you know the person you love, but you never really do.
Right.
Because everybody has parts of themselves that they keep close to the vest. And a lyric that essentially sums it up is, we share so many secrets, but there are some we never tell.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to share like a fun little anecdote. The first time I heard this song on the Greatest Hits album that my dad had in the car, I was very young, maybe like 6 or 7, and I always had a picture in my head of people walking around wearing actual physical masks, just like the one that's on the Stranger album. If you look on the cover, it's just Billy Joel lying in a bed, and it's him looking down at the bed, and on the bed is a very creepy looking simple mask. It's such a great message as well. And I think he also was hinting at this point around his failing first marriage to his wife, Elizabeth Weber, who was also his manager at the time. And there's that other line, once I used to believe I was such a great romancer, but then I came home to a woman that I could not recognize. When I pressed her for a reason, she refused to leave an answer. It was then I felt the stranger kick me right between the eyes. Like, what a powerful sucker punch image.
You know,
that is.
I'm going to go a little off script here, a little weird here.
Yeah.
But, you know, I can't imagine that Billy Joel, who's very well read and very intelligent, like a really smart guy, wasn't thinking like existentialism, like Jean-Paul Sartre and Albert Camus here. Because like, this is such a good discussion of Sartre's concept of bad faith.
Yes.
Like that first verse, well, we all have a face that we hide away forever, and we take them out and show ourselves when everyone has gone. Some are satin, some are steel, some are silk, and some are leather. They're the face of a stranger, but we'd love to try them on. And so this is, you know, bad faith is playing the role of your life inauthentically, living inauthentically, taking on the role of the musician versus being your authentic self. That every time you take on a role, it dehumanizes you, it distances you from authenticity. And so Billy Joel is singing about this concept and how it's affecting his romantic life. That it's not just that this woman character is surprising him with being the stranger. It's that he is the stranger in himself. And what is he contributing to their estrangement from each other?
Right. Because there's that like set of lines. Don't be afraid to try again. Everyone goes south every now and then. You've done it. Why can't someone else? You should know by now. You've been there yourself. So,
and right. It was also talking about his experience of mental illness.
Yes, it's definitely about, just going back to his relationship with Elizabeth Weber very quickly. Elizabeth Weber was married to John Weber when he and Billy were essentially in a band together before Billy went solo, called Attila, and Billy Joel started having an affair with Elizabeth Weber, and the guilt consumed him so much that he had a couple of suicide attempts. His suicide note essentially became a song on his Cold Spring Harbor album called Tomorrow Is Today.
Right.
And has touched upon like suicide and depression in a few of his other songs. But I think just the concept of the stranger being that side of yourself that surprises you, that you don't want to share with other people, and then having it turned around on you when you're with someone you love, expecting them to be their full authentic self when you can't even be your full authentic self to them.
Right. And my final thought on this is the role of the stranger is not the mask, It's what's behind the mask. It's the real you. The authentic you is the stranger. And he's saying that you need to get to know yourself to be authentic.
Exactly.
Which is just like really brilliant.
And that is such a great transition into our next song, which we both love so much.
I love this song.
Just the Way You Are, which I think has a stupid amount of criticism. I'm going to say to those.
Criticism is stupid.
I was going to say, the people who think that the song is not nice to the subject or whatever, you're wrong.
Or to women, that it's misogynistic.
You're incorrect. You are incorrect. Do not agree. So this, in Fred Schur's biography, Billy tells Fred that this was written for his first wife, Elizabeth, and he still believes in the sentiment that this song illustrates for him, everyone wants to be loved and accepted for who they are, not who they appear to be, and not for the mask that you present to the world, which is why I think this is such a great transition from The Stranger, because it's essentially saying, I don't want you to have to try and impress me. I just want you to be you. I love you for exactly who you are. You don't have to change your hair color. You don't have to put on airs. Like, I love you. You don't have to, you don't have to be anything other than yourself. And there's a couple lines that people always go back to that are like, they're like, which is, I don't want clever conversation. I never want to work that hard. He says, the clever conversation is essentially a lyrical device that says, I don't want shallow cocktail chatter. Right. I want real dialogue and I want real communication. That's what I want. And yeah. I feel like it's so easy to misinterpret that line. Do you want to read just that couplet or those set of lines?
You know, actually, I want to take it a little earlier than that first.
Okay, yeah, go ahead. Absolutely.
And in verse 2, we have, don't go trying some new fashion. Don't change the color of your hair. You always have my unspoken passion, although I might not seem to care. I mean, like, here the criticism might be that, like, oh, I don't want you to do what you want and to change the way that you look. I want you to stay the same. What this is saying is, you don't have to do that for me. You don't have to do anything for me. I like you just the way you are. It's acceptance of the other as a whole human being. In the second chorus, I don't want clever conversation. I never want to work that hard. I just want someone that I can talk to. I want you just the way you are. And I think that that chorus really sums up the love where you and your partner are in your pajamas all day.
Yes.
That's what I think of with that chorus. Not,
I do too.
I want to date someone stupid. Because you could say that. Like, you could, other musicians have had that conversation of, I don't like smart women. Like,
which is not what he's saying. He's saying
don't try too hard. Just be yourself. This whole song is like, be yourself. That's correct. And I love you because you are yourself. The bridge right after the second chorus, I need to know that you'll always be the same old someone that I knew. What will it take till you believe in me?
Oh, that set of lyrics always makes me, out of the whole song, that set makes me the most emotional. And he said that, especially with that set of lyrics, he doesn't believe in love songs unless it has like an undertone of anxiety and darkness, because love is not this pure sunshine, rainbows, happiness. There's, you know, insecurity, which is very much throughout this song. It's this nail biting, are you going to change? I don't want you to change. I want us to always be the same together. And it's not necessarily about not growing together. It's just this sentiment that I need you to be that person that I've loved and exactly like as you are.
Right.
I think. And what's so sad about this is in his biography, he says that he played this for Elizabeth as a birthday present. And since she was his manager at the time, her response was, do I get the publishing rights too?
Which I think is hilarious. I love it.
I don't know. I think it's sad. And I
think it's hilarious.
it can be kind of interpreted as a joke, and I think Billy said as much, but then Fred Schur did an interview with someone else who was there when Billy played it for Elizabeth, and she went outside and was smoking a cigarette, and she's like, I couldn't even get the effing publishing rights. So,
you know, if they were having a difficult time in the relationship, maybe this was her way of getting, you know, she knows that he's big, and maybe she wants that for herself.
And he also didn't really love the song, and he was afraid with this song, if he put it on the album, he would be typecast as like a lounge singer or like a wedding singer, and really didn't want to. And he was playing in the studio, and Linda Ronstadt happened to be there, and she was like, you're an idiot if you don't put this on the album. Like, this is like one of the best songs I've ever heard, and this is a hit. You better put it on the album. So he did.
Thank Linda Ronstadt.
Thank you, Linda Ronstadt. And then he said to Fred Schur, he was like, she knew what she was talking about. Shows how much I know about what a hit song is.
I mean, she knows a hit song. She had so many hit songs. To me, this is like the perfect wedding song. Like, it's such a beautiful wedding song. I just want to read the last chorus.
Of course.
I said I love you, and that's forever. And this promise from my heart, I couldn't love you any better. I love you just the way you are. Right.
Ow. Ow.
Ow. Beautiful. And then we get time to spoil the surprise for me. This is my favorite Billy Joel song.
This
is my
too.
Favorite song on the album. This is such a fucking genius song.
And it closes out our side one.
And it closes out side one.
It's drumroll, please. Ba-ba-ba-ba-ba. Scenes from an Italian restaurant. It is Billy Joel's best. I think it's also Billy Joel's favorite song of his, which I'm like, of course
so
it is
good.
Billy Joel.
It's such a good song. It's
banger.
So brilliant.
Banger to the
brilliant.
Upteenth degree.
Banger to the max. I mean, when he played this at the concert, people really went insane.
Oh, like, my dad and I were screaming the lyrics to this.
Everyone's singing every... This song has a ton of lyrics. It's a very lyric-heavy song, and everyone's singing every line.
It's 7.5 minutes.
It's such an opus. It is so, so good. So let's go into it.
Let's go into it. Okay.
We're going to take like 40 minutes to do this song, but we're going to do it.
We're going to do it. We're going to tackle this together. Okay. So, woo. All right. Having my come down moment. All right.
Your come down moment from the euphoria of doing this song.
Yes. Okay. So, very similar to Funeral for a Friend, Love Lives Bleeding, this song is not just one song, but it's three songs in one.
Right.
So, we have the first part, which is literally just called Italian Restaurant. And it's where Billy Joel sets the scene for us on our narrator and his old friend. And they're catching up at their favorite Italian restaurant. And it opens up with that beautifully classic line, which was actually said to Billy Joel at the restaurant that inspired the song. A bottle of white, a bottle of red, perhaps a bottle of rosé instead. We'll get a table near the street.
In our familiar place.
You and I, face to face. From the moment this song opens, the shift in tone. In the beginning, you're in the restaurant, and it feels like this sweeping, romantic piano ballad.
And you hear that. You hear that in the piano, and you feel like you're in the restaurant. Because if you've ever been to an Italian restaurant in New York City, every Italian restaurant wants to flex how Italian it is.
Yes. So let's talk about how the scene is set, because we start in the present where these two people are catching up, and then it very quickly goes to a reminiscent. But I want to stay in the present. I want to stay in this first part for a second. Do you kind of want to analyze how we get to know these two characters in that very first part before we go into our very jazzy transition?
So our first verse gives us a really good picture of the characters in the song. Things are okay with me these days. Got a good job, got a good office, got a new wife, got a new life, and the family is fine. Oh, lost touch long ago. You lost weight. I did not know you could ever look so nice after so much time. This tempo is really frenetic. It's really quick.
But it's excitement. You're so excited that you're seeing this person. It's either like an old friend. I'm guessing old friend or old lover.
Right.
And you're catching up and you're just so excited to see them. And you're like launching into the gossip, serving right. the tea, serving right. the wine.
Right. And it's this kind of like optimistic and a little bit of that like stranger mask moment where yes. you're kind of putting on airs to impress each other. But it's so conversational. It's like you could hear this conversation on like an alfresco dining experience. You could hear people catching up.
I was going to say, this is literally the I went to my 10-year high school reunion, which was such a surreal.
Oh, I did not.
It was such a weird and surreal experience. But that's like almost every conversation I had with friends. It's like, I'm working here now. I got married. Everything's great. I have a baby now. Like, it's everyone has like these different kinds of bragging rights that they right. want to share now that we're out of high school. And, you know, just now that we've grown up, it's like different kinds of bragging rights. So,
yeah,
it's very reminiscent of like a high school reunion discussion. But because clearly there's that line, lost touch long ago. Right. So that, like, you have a sense that they really haven't spoken in a very long time, and whatever caused them to start catching up, they have a lot to catch up on.
Right. And again, pre-Facebook, pre-internet, like, you really wouldn't talk to this person.
Yeah, we'd have to look them up in a phone book.
Right. Or hear about someone. I want to look at verse 2. What I think is really interesting is that freneticism changes just slightly. And you transition into verse 2, which is a much more intimate conversation. It's a much more vulnerable conversation. You remember those days hanging out in the Village Green. Engineer boots, leather jackets, and tight blue jeans. Oh, you drop a dime in the box and play a song about New Orleans. Cold beer, hot lights, my sweet romantic teenage nights. You get the sense that there are a couple of glasses in these people. And they start reminiscing about these glory days of hanging out like in town. And having these teenage experiences.
Yes.
And it sets up the next verse we'll talk about in just a moment. But I want to highlight how the brilliance that Billy Joel has here. You have this incredibly powerful sensory image in a couple of lines.
I know. In almost no lines. It's brilliant. It is brilliant.
He is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 lines. He gives you exactly where you want to go in this memory. And I want to reflect on like Billy Joel as a brilliant writer a little bit more and say,
of course. Yes, because he is.
We are now in like second layer of nested narrative. So he's really good at this in the song where he has nested narratives. We have our buddies at the Italian restaurant. We actually have a narrator. And with the narrator is narrating the buddies at the Italian restaurant who get some dialogue. And now they are reminiscing this scene, which is another layer of nesting. The next verse is going to be another layer of nesting. So this is something that Chaucer was very famous for in the Canterbury Tales.
Yes.
That I had to write a paper on in undergrad. And Chaucer gets up to something like 50 levels of nested narrative in a couple of his stories. And Billy Joel gets there too. The reason why I'm bringing it up is because you get transported so many times throughout the story to different places and to different ideas, different thoughts.
I just love the transition from that sweeping romantic, you're in the Italian restaurant, and then all of a sudden you're in this upbeat jazz tempo. You go from yeah. sweeping piano ballad to jazz, and you kind of feel like you're just very quickly being pushed into that mood of excitement, that mood of, oh my God, I have something crazy to tell you. Like, I need to tell you this. And you literally feel like you're in the mood of that narrator. And I just find it, again, going back to what you were talking about at the top of the episode, how Billy Joel wrote the music and the lyrics. Brilliant. Speechless. Brilliant. And I will say I'm very sad that we don't know much about this other person he's talking to other than the fact that they lost a lot of weight.
Yeah.
That's all we know about this poor other person that they're talking to, that they lost a lot of weight.
And so moving on from that verse, though, we have this really, really like transportive New Orleans jazz segue. And then we hit the core of the song,
which is the third and final part.
I have to read the lyrics.
You are more than welcome to read the lyrics. I know. I'm very excited about this. But Billy Joel calls this last part of the song, The Ballad of Brenda and Eddie. He pronounces it Brender.
That sounds like Brender, because he's a New Yorker.
It's Brender and Eddie throughout the whole thing. But before you read the lyrics, now we're in the core of the song, which is where the narrator is talking to his friend about this couple that they clearly knew in high school, Brenda and Eddie, and how they're the couple that peaked in high school. They were the prom king and queen, never really should have gotten together, but it was kind of what they were supposed to do. And yet they went nowhere in life and it ended in shambles. And I think we'll start with the lyric analysis there and then we'll get into the message of the song. So yeah. Jeffrey, take it away with reading the lyrics. I'm so excited too.
Brenda and Eddie were the popular steadies and the king and the queen of the prom. Riding around with the car top down and the radio on. Nobody looked any finer or was more of a hit at the Parkway Diner. We never knew we could want more than that out of life. Surely Brenda and Eddie would always know how to survive. So that first verse, you have the king and the queen of the prom. They're showing off. They're looking great. Everyone wants to be them.
Yes.
Everyone wants to be a hit at the Parkway Diner. Can I just tell you, I love that.
I do just too.
At the Parkway Diner, this is something that like my parents always talk about. So my dad's from the Bronx. My mother's from Yonkers. And they were like their dates and their hangouts wouldn't always be in like Manhattan. Like people think, oh, Manhattan clubbing, all that. My parents would go to like Central Avenue and Yonkers all the time and hang out at different diners. This is like such an experience for people who live like on the outer rims of the city that like people would drive out of the city, go to a diner. The Parkway Diner is a real place. You would see all of these people that you know there. This diner culture thing is prevalent enough where like all of their friends did this. People's parents will tell me this. We'll have these conversations where like it seems like the whole city went to the diners on Central Avenue in Yonkers. And I just think that's such an interesting detail that tells you so much about these two characters. Verse 4, we have this complete change. We have a little bit of a
foreshadowing.
Moment. Foreshadowing. Brenda and Eddie were still going steady in the summer of 75 when they decided the marriage would be at the end of July. Everyone said they were crazy. Brenda, you know that you're much too lazy and Eddie could never afford to live that kind of life. Oh, but there we were waving Brenda and Eddie goodbye.
So you literally have that picture of all of like the class or their friends, the people that grew up with them sitting. I can picture it like outside the church, the car is pulling away with the just married sign on the car and they're waving them goodbye to send them off on their new married life, even though everyone's like, it's kind of the couple that you're like, all right, how long do you think they're going to last? Let's place bets.
Well, we find out maybe a minute later, we start talking about how like Brenda and Eddie were a terrible match because Brenda is much too lazy and Eddie can't afford anything. What is next is the bridge, which is just a rock bridge. You hear Billy saying, yeah, rock and roll. And there's this like rock and roll interlude.
With the saxophone solo.
And then transitions into verse 6, which is Billy singing in his head voice. Well, they lived for a while in a very nice style, but it's always the same in the end. This is harmonized, actually. They got a divorce as a matter of course, and they parted the closest of friends. Then the king and the queen went back to the green, but you can never go back there again. As if to say they wanted to go back to being high schoolers and being the center of attention, being the hit at the Parkway Diner. But you can't go back to that, especially after you destroy everyone's lives and your own. You know, you got married on a whim.
Right.
And then we have verse 7, the rest of the story. Brenda and Eddie had it already by the summer of 75. So they got married in 75.
I don't know if that means they got divorced in 75 or it was around the time when they started to fight when the money got tight.
No.
So that moment.
Brenda and Eddie were still going steady in the summer of 75 when they decided the marriage would be at the end of July.
Oh, and so like literally within like less than a year, like everything turned to crap.
less than a month. Like in August, they got divorced.
So then like if you really get into it, you can imagine them literally like having this spending spree. So
July, the end of July, they get married.
go on a spending spree.
They've had it already by the end of the summer of 75, which is August. God. So you could say September if you want to be literal. You can say Labor Day. By Labor Day, they get divorced. From the high to the low to the end of the show, for the rest of their lives, they've had it with each other. They couldn't go back to the greasers. The greasers being, you know, referencing to...
the engineer, like, boots, leather jackets, right, tight blue jeans, the cool kids.
The best they could do was pick up their pieces. We always knew they would both find a way to get by. So regardless, going back to the original verse mentioning Brenda and Eddie, where everyone thought they were going to be fine. And that's all I heard about Brenda and Eddie. We're emerging from this story back into the Italian restaurant.
Yes.
Can't tell you more because I told you already. And here we are waving Brenda and Eddie goodbye.
Full circle.
Full circle.
Full circle. They wave goodbye at the wedding and they wave goodbye to the story of Brenda and Eddie. And you're still in that frenetic. I know. I'm so excited about it. You're still in that frenetic tempo. And he's saying it so quickly. Like, that's all I heard about Brenda and Eddie. And I can't tell you more because I told you already. And here we are waving Brenda and Eddie goodbye. That's how, like, quickly right, he's going. You have that sense that this is your friend who's so excited to tell you the gossip. I'm guessing this other person has not heard about Brenda and Eddie and right, is very excited to hear about what happened to Brenda and Eddie. But
there's so many, like, moments where you can almost hear the question that's being asked by the other person as the,
like,
as
that's
the narrator.
Is there any more?
Right.
And they're like, I can't tell you more because I told you everything I know. That's all I know. I don't know where they're at now. I would love, like, an epilogue song that's like,
yeah,
Brenda is here, Eddie is here, but, like, it's literally they've kind of vanished into this.
The way that
unknown.
You would, like, you know, whenever you and I talk about people we knew in high school and college. Well, we didn't know anyone together in high school, but in college, you know, we talk about these people and we're like, what is so and so doing? Oh, so-and-so's right, doing this. This is what I know about so-and-so.
But Jeffrey, we have social media.
Yeah, but we can't find it that much.
I mean, we can look it up on a whim. Like, this is a different time.
I mean, like, you know, we both know people that we really can't look up.
I only talk to, like, 5 people from college now.
High so. 5 people that we both know. then we have the outro, which returns us to the beginning of the song, Bottle of Red, Bottle of White, with this beautiful crescendo. Whatever kind of mood you're in tonight, I'll meet you anytime you want in our Italian restaurant. That's them saying goodbye.
Cue me crying. It's fine.
So we really have spoken, like, at this point about 20 minutes about this song.
I have no regrets.
We got to talk about, like, what the message is.
So the message, I think, that is pretty much the overall message of the song is that Brenda and Eddie were, like, the pinnacle of the glory days. Like, they were right, the symbol of the glory days. And everyone else kind of moved on and built their own lives. And Brenda and Eddie, like, tried to go back to the glory days, or, as he says in the song, pick up their pieces. And it's kind of like, you can't put Humpty Dumpty back together again after it's broken. You can't go back to the past. You can't go back in time. And I just find it ironic because you have these two people sitting in an Italian restaurant together, and the whole premise is to relive those glory days and kind of revel in the fact that these two people who were considered the it couple, like, who you wanted to be, everyone envied them. They were the hit at the Parkway Diner, and now they're nobody.
Now they're nobody.
And now they're reveling in that. So it's really like a song of innocence lost, lesson learned in how, you know, don't idolize the high school jock and princess, because in reality, for the most part, they're really not going to go anywhere. Not to generalize that, because I don't necessarily believe that. I think that I can go on a whole rant about, like, what popular actually means, but, like, you have a lot of stereotypes here.
Yeah. We'll let, like, Stephen Schwartz's Wicked handle that.
Yes, yes, exactly. But I think it's really a song about how much value we put into nostalgia.
Right. It's warning you about nostalgia.
Warning you about nostalgia. But then you have, as I said, you have Brenda and Eddie's view of nostalgia and trying to go back to the glory days. But then you have, I guess, this healthier version of nostalgia, right, where you're catching up with an old friend, and as long as it's not you and you're right, not going through it and you can revel in someone else's misery, it's a grand old time.
So another nostalgia number.
Another nostalgia number. I was going to say, so now we are closing out of side one and we right, are moving on to side two, and we're moving on to Vienna. And just as an overall comment on this album, one of the things I love so much about the composition of this album is I feel like each song speaks to the next song.
Absolutely.
Or the one preceding it. So we just concluded this epic opus about nostalgia and the power of nostalgia. And now we flip the record over and we turn to Vienna, which is this beautiful number, essentially
absolutely
about
beautiful,
beware of trying to grow up too fast because your whole life is ahead of you. Don't rush your youth. And so, Jeffrey, I'll let you take it away with the lyrical analysis of this.
I love this song. Slow down, you crazy child. You're so ambitious for a juvenile. But then if you're so smart, tell me, why are you still so afraid? Where's the fire? What's the hurry about? You better cool it off before you burn it out. You've got so much to do and only so many hours in a day. But you know that when the truth is told, that you can get what you want or you can just get old, you're gonna kick off before you even get halfway through. Ooh, when will you realize Vienna waits for you? So background on this song, you'll give some more in a moment. But this is like, the song is largely about his father. And the way that these first two verses go are such in the speech of like this paternal figure. And again, this real New Yorker father figure speech.
Right.
So such like, I don't think my father's ever called me a crazy child.
No, but you get that fatherly tone.
I can hear it. Like it's your father not yelling at you, not disappointed in you, but giving you that stern advice.
Yes. And I was just going to say, if you do the math and you look up how old Billy Joel was when he wrote this song, this album released when he was like 27 or 28.
Yeah,
and this is such
young,
a wise song.
Absolutely.
There is so much wisdom packed into this song and all these little life lessons packed into each of these verses, literally like a father handing down this cautionary parable for his child. And so Billy Joel was estranged from his father. His father, his hometown is in Vienna, Austria, and he ended up leaving his family and starting a new life with and remarrying and having more children in Vienna. And Billy Joel ended up going to see his father in Vienna and wrote the song while he was there. And he didn't realize it at the time, but essentially he said later that this was a way to deal with his complicated feelings towards his dad, and that Vienna is a metaphor for the rest of your life. Vienna waits for you. It's that crossroads and a symbol of what awaits you. And there's so much beauty. And if you just take the time to experience it instead of wanting to rush your youth.
And, you know, in 2008, he was interviewed for a New York Times article, and he talked about this as one of his favorite songs he's ever written. And he talks about this idea that like Vienna is this crossroads of the world, and that like for the longest time, it was like the crossroads between the Ottoman Empire and the Austro-Hungarian Empire. It was the crossroads between the Eastern Bloc during the Cold War and the West. And there's like all of this collision of culture. And one of the things he talks about in the article is that the instrument break and a lot of the musical elements of the song are inspired by the works of Kurt Weill. Kurt Weill famously wrote Three Penny Opera. He was a Jewish refugee from World War II. He escaped Germany. It was originally from Vienna. And so even musically, there's this influence from Vienna. I want to go back to the sort of like end chorus.
Yes.
Chorus number three. slow down, you crazy child, and take off phone off the hook and disappear for a while. It's all right. You can afford to lose a day or two. When will you realize Vienna waits for you?
It's such an emotional song.
It's a brilliant song. It's this, you know, this like, you have to give up your assumption that you have to be someone you're not in order to be happy. And you have to just live the way that life is. You don't have to get to Vienna, rush to Vienna. You can be who you are right now. And that's the crossroads.
I just think it's so interesting that he uses Vienna as the metaphor of where he wants to be.
That's where his father wanted to be.
Because he was estranged from his father, the fact that like that was the pinnacle. Vienna is the symbol for where you want to be, almost like heaven.
I don't think the imagery is there for heaven, but I think it's like this European destination.
Right.
This like idealized destination. Because it's very based in reality. It's not based in like, I'm going to do good works and move on. It's one day I'm going to be in Vienna, but it's waiting for you. And again, like Vienna stood the test of time. It lasted through every war that it was through.
Right.
You know, it didn't get bombed out the way that other European cities did. Brilliant song.
Brilliant song. Did you want to touch upon very quickly the Ben Platt version?
Oh,
or
yeah.
Did you want to wait till later? Okay.
Ben Platt did a cover of this in a Netflix show and in The Politician and at the end of the first season. And you can hear the recording without seeing the show. His version of this is so unbelievably good. He sings it so beautifully. And, you know, I think it's like transcendent. It fits the character very well, but I think Ben Platt is just a beautiful singer and just really knew the song. He plays the piano too, so he really understood the song. It's worth a listen. You're not going to find that many Billy Joel covers. He's pretty protective of his songs, but that one somehow made it on. He must have heard Ben Platt sing it, probably. It would be my guess.
Probably.
So next is another really fun song.
Another banger.
It's a real like banger. It's a banger.
Yes, because this is only the good die young. It's all about premarital banging. Premarital banging and Catholic guilt, which.
Oh, we love Catholic guilt.
We do love Catholic guilt. I don't love Catholic guilt because I grew up Catholic. And let me tell you, Catholic guilt is one of the worst things. But
I mean, as a Jew, I would like to remind you, Jewish guilt is a thing.
Okay.
But let's talk about this song. So jaunty, upbeat song.
I am like a sucker for metaphors, and Billy Joel just has the most clever friggin' metaphors in this song. Like, you have such powerful imagery. And again, as someone who was raised Catholic in the church, I'm literally like, oh my God, this is so unbelievably true. And it outlines, it's essentially this guy trying to persuade this Catholic girl to have sex with him, which is against her religion because they are not
his.
And yes, because Billy Joel is Jewish. Billy Joel could care less. But it's a very tongue-in-cheek song that is essentially pro-lust, which is one of the seven deadly sins. And he is all for premarital sex, but it's mostly a song about him trying to get her out of her Catholic guilt and her morals and what she holds so tightly to as a young Catholic girl and the hypocrisy that goes with the Catholic Church.
I want to read the verse for that. Come out, Virginia, don't let me wait. You Catholic girls start much too late. That's like reversing the Catholic guilt onto you. It's pressure. I mean, like, okay, bad to pressure people into sex. We get that.
Yeah, don't do that. We're not advocating that.
But he's reversing the Catholic guilt on her. He's laying guilt. He's saying, you start much too late. You're not experienced enough. You've got to start sooner. The next lyric, all but sooner or later, it comes down to fate. I might as well be the one. That if sooner or later, you're going to lose your virginity. Virginia. I might as well be the guy. I'm the schmuck who's going to do it.
Hammer Meat Nail. Like, he could not have picked like a better name for the dream girl, the unattainable girl, which is actually based on a real person. One of Billy Joel's first crushes was a girl named Virginia Callahan. He took her name and used it in the song, but you have Virginia Virgin.
He went to Catholic school. That's the other thing.
Right, that's right.
He went to Catholic school as a kid.
Yeah,
so that's the other thing about this, is that like he knows this so well, this problem. In the pre-chorus, Welish showed you a statue, told you to pray. They built you a temple and locked you away. Ah, but they never told you the price that you pay for things you might have done. This is a moment that I think you won't notice it if you're just listening to it casually. But those last two lines, those last three lines, ah, but they never told you the price that you pay for the things that you might have done. There's a price for not doing the task, but wishing you had done it. So brilliant.
So I also think that's like a reference to one of the sacraments that you have to make as a Catholic is at a very young age is reconciliation, which is where at like 6, 7 years old, you have to go into a room with a priest and tell them your sins. And then they tell you like, save 10 Hail Marys, say like four Our Fathers, and you go sit and pray, and then theoretically God forgives you after the priest tells you to do those things and you admit your sins. But I always think when he says that line, like, they built you a temple, like the church, and then you go into this room with the priest and you say the things that you might have done. I remember being so young having to make up sins that I had committed because I felt like I had to. At yeah, that age. So
I mean, that is
Catholic like, guilt.
He knows this stuff so well because of his own experience. And then the chorus is, well, only the good die young,
right?
Which is like, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, like a reference to specific saints, like dying young because they're saints.
Well, yeah, but it's also like so many people, especially when someone young dies, it gives them that like pure status and that sort of thing. But just to kind of wrap this up a little bit, I think that this is the best sales pitch.
Oh my God, like, I would sleep with this guy so fast. I would, like, he is so smooth.
He is so smooth.
You might have heard, I run with a dangerous crowd. We ain't too pretty, we ain't too proud. We might be laughing a bit too loud. Oh, but that never hurt no one.
I just have to get to my favorite two lines, which is, I'd rather laugh with the sinners than cry with the saints. So good. It's so brilliant. I'm just, the self-awareness and the awareness, like, looking into the feelings that this girl is clearly feeling.
And then in the third verse, you got a nice white dress and a party on your confirmation. You got a brand new soul.
Yes, that's actually what they believe, though.
He's making a sexual reference there. She's a virgin and a cross of gold right in her cleavage.
I know.
So sexual.
It's very sexual, but it's also a direct reference. There's a belief in the Catholic Church. Confirmation is the last sacrament that you get before marriage, which makes you an adult in the Catholic Church. You are now officially an adult, which theoretically you're now allowed to make your own decisions as an adult, but you can't have sex premaritally. So.
Well, that comes to the bridge much later in the song. You said your mother told you all that I could give you was a reputation. Aw, she never cared for me. Did she ever say a prayer for me?
That's literally him talking about Catholic hypocrisy. Catholic hypocrisy in like 3 or 4 lines. That is some of it.
I love this song.
I love it too.
It's so lyrically interesting.
It really is.
And Billy Joel is like portraying himself as this Jewish bad boy, which is such an ironic thing. Because like Jewish guys have the reputation of being like sweet and nice and sensitive, even in the 70s, and like being doctors and lawyers. So like if you wanted to pick someone for your daughter to lose her virginity to, it should be a Jewish boy by stereotype. And all of that, I think, is subtext here.
Yes.
If you know that Billy Joel's Jewish.
Correct.
I love the song. It's like, it is on that Shakespeare comedy level of
it
like
is.
Sexiness. But I also want to go out on a limb and say John Donne.
Yes,
our
for
favorite
sure.
medieval sexy poet.
Oh my God, I love John Donne.
Talks about the sexuality of like the relationship with Jesus and God. And he is very much in that vein, saying like being a Catholic girl is being a sexual being if you let it happen.
Right.
Brilliant.
It's like, I can't have you, and I'm going to sell it to you that I'm going to have you, and here's why. Forget the Catholic stuff. Moving on, though.
Moving on to a song that's not as exciting. Sexually.
I love this song.
But I love this song so much. This is a really beautiful song. She's always a woman.
She's always a woman. So there's an ongoing theme here. Billy Joel wrote this song for Elizabeth as well. And Elizabeth, as I've said, was his manager at the time. And this was during a time where women were not managers or really executives in the music industry. It was very rare for a woman to have a place of power in really any industry, but particularly the music industry. And Billy saw her get called all kinds of names. Like at one point he was saying they called her a bitch. They said she was tough. They just didn't like her. And he pretty much said it was more of an issue that the men knew that she was a better business person than they were and was just mad about it. But he essentially wrote this song to defend her. It's like, yeah, she's tough at work, but in the end, she's my lady. She can rip you apart at work and be really tough and quote unquote a bitch to you. But in the end, she's always a woman, something pure, something that's mine. And like she could be one way to you, but she's another way to me is the most simple way to describe it. And he really wrote it as like a commentary about how women in business in particular at that time were so incredibly persecuted.
Yeah.
And he had to see it with his wife, but there's a couple lines just jumping ahead. Oh, she takes care of herself is one. She's ahead of her time. He straight up says she's ahead of her time. And it's such like a beautiful compliment. But I think when I was younger, another great summation of this is there's this woman who's clearly very complex and is able to be one thing, which could be seen as a fault, but then she can be another thing. And in the end, he loves her all the same. Jeffrey, what's your take on that?
When I was a kid, I thought like a couple of things. Number one, I thought this woman was kind of cruel and kind of like rough.
Oh,
like,
yeah. It's so easy to say that.
She. This song, I always think of this book, The True Confessions of Charlotte Doyle by Avi.
Interesting.
Which I read in like third grade. And for those of you who never read this book, the character Charlotte Doyle is sailing from England to America under disguise as a boy. And she has to work on the ship. And I don't remember what she was escaping. There was something she had to escape. But she had to portray herself as a man. And she had to like learn how to handle a gun and a sword and do rigging and do all of the things that like boys do on sailing ships. I get this image of this like, not girl boss character, but like tough as nails woman who just does not desire
to
deal
with
crap.
Does not give any crap.
Doesn't give crap. And another example of this kind of character, I would say, is like Princess Leia.
Yes.
Like Princess Leia does not suffer fools. Like, she will shoot first, ask questions later.
Yes. Yes. So true.
There's a lot of lyrics in the song. It is very lyric heavy.
It is very lyric heavy.
Followed a really similar form where he just describes her every line. And usually most of the lines start with the word she, with the pronoun she, referring almost to her as if she's in the room with you. And he's kind of like even like almost explaining softly, this is who she is. This is what she's like. So a couple of like one of my favorite lines is, and she'll promise you more than the Garden of Eden. Then she'll carelessly cut you and laugh while you're bleeding.
It's such a great dichotomy of images.
And we have a real dichotomy in the next line. But she'll bring out the best and the worst you can be. Blame it all on yourself. Because she's always a woman to me. I just love that imagery. That she'll promise more than the Garden of Eden. Almost like making fun of the idea that you have this like virginal image, that you have this like Eve image of women is like ridiculous. And she doesn't care if you think of her that way, because she will cut at you and laugh at you for thinking of her that way. She'll bring out the best and the worst you can be. She'll make you this brilliant musician that you are, Billy Joel, and then bring out the worst in you, your jealousy, your envy, your disbelief at you, how angry you can get at her. And then you blame it all on yourself. It's your fault because she is the woman in your life.
Gaslighting.
Yeah.
A little bit.
Yeah, I could see that. You know, he's not the most advanced guy.
No, and I was going to say that he totally says that along with Just the Way You Are, this song is very misunderstood as well. It's supposed to be a celebration of Elizabeth and, again, acknowledge that she may be tough in business, but at home, she is everything that he wants. And even describes all these faults, as you said, and still he loves her. But again, everything that you just said, it's just kind of sad because it's supposed to be this celebration of her, and yet she does all these, like, quote-unquote terrible things, and she can be quite cruel, as you said. In his biography, Billy Joel describes to Fred Schur how they ended up not only being divorced, but her brother, who also got involved in the business side of things, and he ended up stealing his money and embezzled money. So it just was a really sad way to end their marriage.
You know, I think that's really summed up in the last verse. She's frequently kind and she's suddenly cruel. She can do as she pleases. She's nobody's fool. But she can't be convicted. She's earned her degree. And the most that she'll do is throw shadows at you. But she's always a woman to me. I mean, like, this whole time, the missing comparison is to a man. You know, the comparison that's in the story is, like, she is all of these things. I am none of these things. It's, like, very much honoring this woman. But the other comparison is, like, a man would do these things. Like, these are all things that men do.
Well, that's what he was kind of trying to say in defending her, and what he was saying in terms of how he's complimenting her as a businesswoman. Like, she is able to bring that to the table in business, and kind of says to these guys, she's a lot better at business than you, and you're just saying these terrible things about her because you envy her. But in the end, she can be all these things, but in the end, I just love that dichotomy of image of, like, tough to soft. Like, everything that, when you think of a woman, it's like the opposite side of the coin.
Yeah.
Of everything that he just described.
Right.
About her.
And then we have our next song.
This is where the hits end. No more hits.
These last two songs, you know, our beloved audience,
I'm over them.
We really are going to struggle with these, and we're going to move through them quickly.
There's honestly not a ton to say about them.
So Get It Right the First Time, I think you say it best when you say this is a prelude to Tell Her About It, Billy Joel's later hit. And really, like, the song is like, make a good first impression because you don't want to miss your opportunity. My most sophisticated argument about this song is that it's kind of like the mirror of Only the Good Die Young. It's the foil, where Only the Good Die Young is this, like, super confident guy who really wants to, like, woo Virginia. And this one is like, this is the serious girlfriend. That's what this song is about.
If you only had one shot, one opportunity to seize everything you ever wanted. I'm kidding. I'm sorry. Right, I did not mean to bring Eminem into Billy Joel. But it's the same sentiment. It's that he's hoping to impress this girl and he knows he only has one chance to shoot his shot. And it's set to this very funky disco beat.
Yeah.
And one of the things that Billy Joel really likes to do is emulate either, like, a different genre or people that he admires. He does an album later, which is all just reminiscent of, like, 50s doo-wop, like, paying tribute. He likes to pay tribute a lot to different genres, and I think this is his way of paying tribute to funk and disco, because this is 1977.
Yeah.
This is 1977. This is when that genre is like very active and very popular. So it also has this like anxious and childlike tone. It moves very quickly, and it's this like, oh my gosh, like I gotta impress her, like I only have one chance and there is no second chance, and it's not the same if I do get a second chance, like I gotta shoot for the moon here. And it's just this, I'm gonna screw up, like I just need this girl, I want this girl so badly. And it definitely has that teenage anxiety, insecurity kind of feel to it.
Yeah, it absolutely has that feel to it. And I mean, I think that the song isn't unsuccessful. I think it just pales in comparison to the rest of the album. It's just not as elevated and not as creative and not as like lyrically dynamic.
Well, I think Billy Joel kind of said about this song that this is the breather.
This is the breather is right.
This is the breather.
This is the breather.
This is kind of like the palate cleanser.
Palate cleanser.
It's like the breath mint after like a very full course.
This is the soft end to the album. This is something that whenever I make a playlist, I like to structure a playlist where I have like a soft entrance song, like a song that like introduces the theme of the playlist. And then I like to have like a hard start where really the narrative that I'm trying to create with the playlist, the composition, like happens. And then I always like to do a soft ending where you think like the narrative of the playlist is over. And then I do like one or two, maybe three encore songs. And I think that's what happens here is like in a musical or in an operetta, you might have like the song that is the narrative end. And then you have the entr'acte or you have the outro or you have the curtain call song. And you see this all the time where you have like in Oklahoma's perfect example, Oklahoma, the song is the last song, but you always have a reprise of Oklahoma to really say goodbye to the audience. And I think that's kind of what this is. This song really right. cleans up the end of the album. And then our next song is the hard end of the album.
Everybody Has a Dream, which I gotta say, for this being my favorite album, this is a terrible track.
This is such a hard song to like.
Absolutely garbage track.
So hard to like this song.
I don't like this song. The only thing I like about this song is that it ends with that whistle from the stranger, and I don't want to jump ahead. I'm just going to get to the overall theme of this song. So Billy Joel wanted it to be like a gospel celebration
right.
of the end of The Stranger, like literally the celebratory, like, yay, the album's over and now we're gonna close it out with this like jubilant gospel number, which again kind of is him paying tribute to that gospel style.
Yeah,
so it's very hymn-like. And for background, again, he's clearly been struggling with his relationship with Elizabeth, and it's a callback to a song on Piano Man called You're My Home.
Right.
Which is pretty much the sentiment is, I can go anywhere with you.
It's a great
and
song.
And it is a great song. And you are my home. And it's also reminiscent to Moving Out, where
absolutely.
It calls back and brings it full circle. And Moving Out, these people in Moving Out are trying to buy all these luxury things to say that they have made it in America and get that status. And Billy Joel is saying in this song, like, I don't need any of that. I just need you. And
absolutely.
That's kind of where I want to end my analysis. And it, for such a celebratory song, it still has that undertone that they are struggling and he's praying for them to stay together. And unfortunately, you know, they don't.
I want to highlight the second verse and the chorus, and just because that, I think, gives the song its real meat. If I believe in all the words I'm saying, and if a word from you can bring a better day, then all I have are these games that I've been playing to keep my hope from crumbling away. So let me lie and let me go on sleeping, and I will lose myself in places of sand and all the fantasies that I will be keeping will make the empty hours easier to stand. I know that everybody has a dream. Everybody has a dream. And this is my dream, my own, just to be at home and to be alone with you. I think the sentiment is really beautiful. I think the melody does not carry it.
It's so poorly executed. It's 6.5 minutes, and I think like 3.5 minutes of it is being like, everybody has a dream. Like 3.5 minutes.
Right. It's
of
like
that.
This Disney-ish moment. I would like this maybe more as an acoustic song or just the piano. The moments there that I just want to point out, and then we can end, is, you know, you have this nice sort of like reconciliation of the themes of the album of being with you, lying in bed, letting the sands of dreams take me away, and all the fantasies that I'll be keeping will make the empty hours of working at the grocery store at Mr. Cacciatore's easier to stand. Everyone has a dream, and just to be at home with you is my dream. Which is a really beautiful sentiment. And I think that the melody just betrays it. And that's my analysis on this song. I don't have much for it.
I just wanted to touch upon, and you let me know what you think of this, the fact, though, that it ends with that ominous whistle
right
at the beginning of the song Stranger, I feel like says so much. Because as much as Billy Joel wanted this to be a celebratory end to The Stranger, in the end, you still are left with the parts of yourself that you can't share with your right lover.
I love that. There's this whistle, this quiet remembrance of the stranger who is
always there. Stranger is always there. Whew. You cannot escape the stranger.
This is such a brilliant album.
Except for those last two tracks.
I don't think they're terrible. I do think
Everybody Has a Dream is terrible.
I don't think it detracts from the composition of the album. And that's really, like, I want to touch on that, is the composition of this album is real proof that, like, composition matters in an album. By this time, we had already seen, like, the Beatles create purposeful composition in their albums, more like narrative-based than just where do we put tracks so that they'll get played on the radio. You know, and this album works the way that, like, a book of poetry or novel works. And I think that's Billy Joel's, like, production genius, as well as his lyrical and musical genius, is that when working with his producer, Phil Ramone, he was able to advocate for or create just the narrative of this album so well.
Right.
So that's a wrap on The Stranger.
That is a wrap on The Stranger.
Do we have anything else to say about The Stranger?
It's a storytelling album. You have so many different colorful characters. And seeing him perform some of these songs live. So amazing. I got to see him twice, as you said. The first time I went with my dad, and it was such an important experience for me because at that point, my dad and I had drifted apart. And he had tickets to go see Billy Joel, and he was originally, I think, going to take my mom, and my mom didn't end up going, and he asked me to go. And it was such a beautiful bonding moment, and I remember just being very, very teary and crying when he came on the stage, because I was immediately back to, like, being in my dad's little apartment in Nutley, New Jersey, and the boombox in his room, and just literally, like, taken back in time, it felt like. And especially with scenes from an Italian restaurant, everyone's screaming.
Amazing.
As soon as the tempo changes, like, things are okay with me these days.
I
like, everyone's screaming.
I can remember
that
so clearly, how everyone sang every lyric of that song. Everyone cheered when he played it.
7.5 minutes, and everyone knew all the words.
I loved that experience so much.
He's such a dynamic performer,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, he's crazy good in performance.
He's crazy good. For both times that I saw him, my dad and I had nosebleed seats. Seats are not cheap to go
at
see
the
him
Garden?
In concert.
No way.
It's not cheap to see him in concert at all. And we had just watching the video of him on the screen with his hands, literally, it seemed like they were flying across the piano. Yeah. It was absolutely crazy. And then, not to take away from The Stranger, two really good song performances that he did. Number one was Big Shot. He goes, like, all out for Big Shot.
Oh, yeah.
we were laughing, my dad and I, he like gets a backwards baseball cap and like starts like strutting around the stage doing the big shot persona. And it's a really humorous moment. He's a very funny person.
He's hilarious. He's hilarious. Really funny. Something that didn't happen when I was there, but my parents went to see him when Elton John was there, or Elton had just left. And Billy Joel has this rotating stage that he rotates on it, and it shows spins so that he can see the whole audience. Elton John only has a little bit of that. And apparently when my parents saw Billy Joel, he said to the audience, you know, Elton John doesn't have one of these. He doesn't have one of these. I don't know why he can afford it. Great. And when we saw him, I saw him with my brother, and he was like flipping. He took the microphone stand and was like doing flips with it. He was like throwing it up in the air. And one of the members of AC/DC had just died. And one of his bandmates had recorded with them. And so they did Highway to Hell, where Billy's playing the guitar. And this guy who's in the band with him sings Highway to Hell. And it was incredible. It was incredible. People were screaming that Billy Joel was playing the guitar.
I cannot see that picture in my head of him doing Highway to Hell.
Yeah.
But I was just going to say one more thing, I guess, before we close out about Billy Joel. Another performance he did in concert was Goodnight Saigon. And that song is about the Vietnam War. And talk about absolutely visceral and gut-punching storytelling song. He brought up on stage, or I guess they were backstage, a series of Vietnam veterans or war veterans in general, and they all sang the part "And We Would All Go Down Together."
Right.
My dad and I were sobbing. After it was so emotional. It's such an emotional song about war and lives lost and lives that could have been lived.
He has great respect because he didn't go to Vietnam. He got out of it.
No, he didn't.
He felt very guilty about it, and he wrote that song to honor people who served in Vietnam.
The detail in that song is so real. I believe my mom told me when we were first listening to that song, she's like, oh yeah, like Billy Joel like went to war and like knew all. I just think because of the level of detail, it seems like he was there.
He interviewed people. Like he went and talked to a lot of people to get those details. I know that's what happened with it. But yeah, he's like really like lyrically and musically such a brilliant musician. And
really
defined the 70s, even, and really is like one of the grand masters of rock and roll. You know, he is enormously honorate. He loves other like great musicians. He always says that Paul McCartney is like his number one like fan.
Ray Charles,
he's the number one fan of Ray Charles and Paul McCartney. He's really responsible for creating a lot of the musical diversity that we see in modern pop rock. And creating sort of like a high level of rock and pop. And him and Elton John really brought piano into rock and roll in a whole new way. Really pushed the boundaries of how that instrument can contribute to popular music.
Right. 100%. But what an epic, for 9 songs, it is an epic, beautiful album. And with that, Jeffrey, did you want to talk about the next album that we're going to be covering?
So our next album is going to be probably one of the greatest albums of all time. We've done a bunch of those. I probably said that every time. But it's going to be one that is so well known that you probably don't even remember how well you know it. It's Carole King's 1971 Tapestry. Which was
it's
at
been
one
raining
time.
Men for a while, and now we want to be getting into women. We've been covering men. Now it's time to talk about the important ladies and important albums written and sung by women.
So get excited for Tapestry in our next episode.
And this is another album that I didn't, as you said, Jeffrey, I really didn't realize how many songs I knew on this album until I started listening to it. And
you know, we'll go over the statistics in the album, but this was at one time like the top selling album of all time, period, for like the longest time. And we'll go over it as one
we'll
of the biggest deals. And for now, so long,
farewell. Alvita Zane, goodbye. Goodbye to the stranger. And we will see you all again next time.